This is the Stillwater Revival Books audiobook selection. Please join us at PuritanDownloads.com to see all the new 99-cent digital downloads, Reformation and Puritan books, Psalm singing MP3s, and so on, the new SWRB Puritan hard drive, and much more. The new website is state-of-the-art and contains Puritan hard drive videos, Puritan quo videos, free samples of psalm singing, MP3s, a powerful search engine, new material, Puritan books, MP3s and videos, that you may follow through an RSS feed, and it is very easy to navigate. That's PuritanDownloads.com. Richard Baxter, who lived from 1615 to 1691, was one of the better known and reprinted Puritans in his day and in ours. But in our day, his name has fallen on hard times. The reason for this is he was an Almoraldian. In other words, he might not have been a full five-point Calvinist and fully reformed. But also, his doctrine of justification is muddy. It's not always sound. And for this reason, at least three times in the last 6 months, I saw contempt poured upon the writings of Richard Baxter by many in my own camp who I think would do well to read his other works that are more sound, such as The Reformed Pastor, Now or Never, Directions to a Sound Convert, because some of this stuff is so stirring and so arresting, and our state in this day of the church is in such a melancholy, slothful, and backslidden condition compared to the piety of a Richard Baxter. But another thing that you want to consider is that others held him in high esteem. I won't comment on this at great length, but just to read the introduction from the American Tract Society's version of The Saint's Everlasting Rest, which was written by Benjamin Fawcett. But before I do that, I would like to quote from The Reformed Pastor, so that if you haven't yourself read the earnest and powerful and soul-searching words of Richard Baxter, you may be at least acquainted with him. Listen to these expostulations by Richard Baxter in his famous work, The Reformed Pastor, as he exhorts other pastors to diligence in their labors. And now, brethren, what have we to do for the time to come but to deny our lazy flesh and rouse up ourselves to the work before us? The harvest is great. The laborers are few. The loiterers and hinderers are many. The souls of men are precious. The misery of sinners is great, and the everlasting misery to which they are near is greater. The joys of heaven are inconceivable. The comfort of a faithful minister is not small. The joy of extensive success will be a full reward. To be fellow workers with God in the Spirit is no little honor. To subserve the bloodshedding of Christ for men's salvation is not a light thing. To lead on the armies of Christ through the thickest of the enemy, to guide them safely through a dangerous wilderness, to steer the vessel through such storms and rocks and sands and shells, and bring it safe to the harbor of rest, requireth no small skill and diligence. The fields now seem even white unto harvest. The preparations that have been made for us are very great. The season of working is more calm than most ages before us have ever seen. We have carelessly loitered too long already. The present time is posting away, while we are trifling men are dying. Oh, how fast are they passing into another world? And is there nothing in all this to awaken us to our duty? Nothing to resolve us to speedy and unwearied diligence? Can we think that a man can be too careful and painful under all these motives and engagements? Or can that man be a fit instrument for other men's illumination who is himself so blind, or for the quickening of others who is himself so senseless? What, brethren, are ye, who are men of wisdom, as dull as the common people? And do we need to heap up a multitude of words to persuade you to a known and weighty duty? one would think it should be enough to set you on work, to show a line in the book of God to prove it to be his will, or to prove to you that the work has a tendency to promote men's salvation. One would think that the very sight of your miserable neighbors would be motive sufficient to draw out your most compassionate endeavors for your relief. If a cripple do but enlap his sores and show you his disabled limbs, it will move you without words. And will not the case of souls that are near to damnation move you? Oh, happy church, if the physicians were but healed themselves, and if we had not too much of that infidelity and stupidity against which we daily preach in others, and were more soundly persuaded of that of which we persuade others, and were more deeply affected with the wonderful things with which we would affect them, were there but such clear and deep impressions upon our own souls of those glorious things that we daily preach. Oh, what a change would it make in our sermons and in our private course of life. Oh, what a miserable thing it is to the church and to themselves that men must preach of heaven and hell before they soundly believe that there are such things or have felt the weight of the doctrines which they preach. It would amaze a sensible man to think what manners we preach and talk of. What it is for the soul to pass out of this flesh and appear before a righteous God and enter upon unchangeable joy or unchangeable torment. Oh, with what amazing thoughts do dying men apprehend these things? How should such manners be preached and discoursed of? Oh, the gravity, the seriousness, the incessant diligence which these things require. I know not what others think of them, but for my own part I am ashamed of my stupidity, and wonder at myself that I deal not with my own and other souls as one that looks for the great day of the Lord, and that I can have room for almost any other thoughts or words, and that such astonishing manners do not wholly absorb my mind. I marvel how I can preach of them slightly and coldly, and how I can let men alone in their sins, and that I do not go to them and beseech them for the Lord's sake to repent, however they take it, and whatever pains or trouble it should cost me. I seldom come out of the pulpit, but my conscience smiteth me, that I have been no more serious and fervent in such a case. It accuses me not so much for want of ornaments or elegancy, nor for letting fall an unhandsome word, but it asketh me, how couldst thou speak of life and death with such a heart? How couldst thou preach of heaven and hell in such a careless, sleepy manner? Dost thou believe what thou sayest? Art thou in earnest or in jest? How canst thou tell people that sin is such a thing, and that so much misery is upon them and before them, and be no more affected with it? Shouldst thou not weep over such a people, and should not thy tears interrupt thy words? Shouldst not thou cry aloud and show them their transgressions, and entreat and beseech them as for life and death? Truly this is a peal that conscience doth ring in my ears, and yet my drowsy soul will not be awakened. Oh, what a thing is a senseless, hardened heart! Oh, Lord, save us from the plague of infidelity and hard-heartedness ourselves, or else how shall we be fit instruments of saving others from it? Or do that on our own souls which thou wouldst use us to do on the souls of others. I am even confounded to think what a difference there is between my sick bed apprehensions and my pulpit apprehensions of the life to come. That ever that can seem so light a manner to me now, which seems so great and astonishing a manner then, and I know will do so again when death looks me in the face, when yet I daily know and think of that approaching hour, and yet those four thoughts will not recover such working apprehensions. Oh, brethren, surely if you had all conversed with neighbor death as oft as I have done, and as often received the sentence in yourselves, you would have an unquiet conscience, if not a reformed life, as to your ministerial diligence and fidelity, and you would have something within you that would frequently ask you such questions as these. Is this all thy compassion for lost sinners? Wilt thou do no more to seek and to save them? Is there not such and such and such an one? How many round about thee that are yet the visible sons of death? What hast thou said to them or done for their conversion? Shall they die and be in hell before thou wilt speak to them one serious word to prevent it? Shall they there curse thee forever that didst no more in time to save them? Such cries of conscience are daily ringing in mine ears, though the Lord knows I have too little obeyed them. The God of mercy pardon me and awaken me with the rest of his servants that have been thus sinfully negligent. I confess to my shame that I seldom hear the bell toll for one that is dead, but conscience asketh me, what hast thou done for the saving of that soul before it left the body? There is one more gone to judgment. What didst thou to prepare him for judgment? And yet I have been slothful and backward to help them that survive. How can you choose when you are laying a corpse in the grave, but think with yourselves, here lieth the body, but where is the soul? And what have I done for it before it departed? It was part of my charge. What account can I give of it? O brethren, is it a small matter to you to answer such questions as these? It may seem so now, but the hour is coming when it will not seem so. If our hearts condemn us, God is greater than our hearts, and will condemn us much more, even with another kind of condemnation than conscience doth. The voice of conscience is a still voice, and the sentence of conscience is a gentle sentence, in comparison of the voice and the sentence of God, end quote, the Reformed pastor. In the last few years, we have one man to be thankful for the most part, who's reintroduced the writings of Richard Baxter, and that's J.I. Packer. The Banner of Truth would not publish all of his works. They only published a Reformed pastor, much for the same reason that I have given earlier. But I am happy to see that at this time when I am narrating this, in August of 2010, within a couple of months, Hendrickson Publishers is going to do a 1,000-page hardback edition of the collected works of Richard Baxter. Not the whole four volumes, but I believe it's the same edition as at Summit Books, published in a paperback some time ago, along with some collected works of John Bunyan. And with that introduction, I would now like to read Benjamin Fawcett's prefatory notice to Richard Baxter's Saints' Everlasting Rest. Richard Baxter, the author of The Saints' Rest, so well known to the world by this and many other excellent and useful writings, was a learned, laborious, and eminently holy divine of the last age. He was born near Shrewsbury in 1615 and died at London in 1691. His ministry, in unsettled state, was for many years employed with great and extensive success, both in London and in several parts of the country. But he was nowhere fixed so longer with such entire satisfaction to himself and apparent advantage to others as at Kidderminster. His abode there was indeed interrupted partly by his bad health, but chiefly by the calamities of a civil war. Yet in the whole it amounted to 16 years. Nor was it by any means the result of his own choice, or that of the inhabitants of Kidderminster, that he never settled there again, after his going from thence in 1660. Before his coming there, the place was overrun with ignorance and profaneness. But by the divine blessing on his wise and faithful cultivation, the fruits of righteousness sprung up in rich abundance. He had first found but a single instance or two of daily family prayer in a whole street, and on his going away but one family or two could be found in some streets that continued to neglect it. And on Lord's days, instead of the open profanation to which they had been so long accustomed, a person in passing through the town in the intervals of public worship might overhear hundreds of families engaged in singing psalms, reading the scriptures and other good books, or such sermons as they had taken down while they heard them from the pulpit. His care of the souls committed to his charge and the success of his labors among them were truly remarkable, for the number of his stated communicants rose to 600, of whom he himself declared there were not 12 concerning whose sincere piety he had not reason to entertain a good hope. Blessed be God, the religious spirit which was thus happily introduced is yet to be traced in the town and neighborhood in some degree. Oh, that it were in a greater! And in proportion as that spirit remains, the name of Mr. Baxter continues in the most honorable and affectionate remembrance. As a writer, he has the approbation of some of his greatest contemporaries, who best knew him, and were under no temptation to be partial in his favor. Dr. Barrow said his practical writings were never mended, and his controversial ones seldom confuted. With a view to his casuistical writings, the Honorable Robert Boyle declared he was the fittest man of the age for a casuist, because he feared no man's displeasure, nor hoped for any man's preferment. Bishop Wilkins observed of him that he had cultivated every subject he had handled, that if he had lived in the primitive times he would have been one of the fathers of the church, and that it was enough for one age to produce such a person as Mr. Baxter. Archbishop Usher had such high thoughts of him that by his earnest importunity he put him upon writing several of his practical discourses, particularly that celebrated piece, His Call to the Unconverted. Thomas Manton, as he freely expressed it, thought, Richard Baxter came nearer the apostolical writings than any man in the age. And it is both as a preacher and a writer that William Bates considers him, when in his funeral sermon he says, In his sermons there was a rare union of arguments and motives to convince the mind and gain the heart. All the fountains of reason and persuasion were open to his discerning eye. There was no resisting the force of his discourses without denying reason and divine revelation. He had a marvelous facility and copiousness in speaking. There was a noble negligence in his style, for his great mind could not stoop to the affected eloquence of words. He despised flashy oratory, but his expressions were clear and powerful, so convincing the understanding, so entering the soul, so engaging the affections that those were as deaf as adders who were not charmed by so wise a charmer. He was animated with the Holy Spirit and breathed celestial fire to inspire heat and life into dead sinners and to melt the obdurate in their frozen tomb. His books, for their number, which it seems were more than 120, and variety of matter in them, make a library. They contain a treasure of controversial, casuistical, and practical divinity. His books of practical divinity have been effectual for more numerous conversions of sinners to God than any printed in our time, and while the church remains on earth, will be of continual efficacy to recover lost souls. There is a vigorous pulse in them that keeps the reader awake and attentive. To these testimonies may not improperly be added that of the editors of his practical works in 4 folio volumes, in the preface to which they say, Perhaps there are no writings among us that have more of a true Christian spirit, a greater mixture of judgment and affection, or a greater tendency to revive pure and undefiled religion, that have been more esteemed abroad or more blessed at home for awakening the secure, instructing the ignorant, confirming the wavering, comforting the dejected, recovering the profane or improving such as are truly serious than the practical works of this author, end quote. Such were the apprehensions of eminent persons who were well acquainted with Baxter and his writings. It is therefore the less remarkable that Mr. Addison, from an accidental and very imperfect acquaintance, but with his usual pleasantness and candor, should mention the following incident, quote, I once met with a page of Mr. Baxter. Upon the perusal of it, I conceived so good an idea of the author's piety that I bought the whole book, end quote. Whatever other causes might concur, it must chiefly be ascribed to Baxter's distinguished reputation as a preacher and a writer, that, presently after the Restoration, he was appointed one of the chaplains in ordinary to King Charles II, and preached once before him in that capacity, as also that he had an offer made him by Lord Chancellor Clarendon, by the Bishopric of Hereford, which in a respectful letter to his lordship he saw proper to decline. The Saint's Rest is deservedly esteemed one of the most valuable parts of his practical work. He wrote when he was far from home, without any book to consult but his Bible, and in such an ill state of health as to be in continual expectation of death for many months, and therefore merely for his own use. He fixed his thoughts on this heavenly subject, which, he says, has more benefited me than all the studies of my life. It is time he could be little more than 30 years old. He afterwards preached over the subject in his weekly lecture at Kidderminster, and in 1650 published it. Indeed, it appears to have been the first that ever he published of his practical writings. Of this book, Dr. Bates says, quote, "It was written by him when languishing in the suspense of life and death, but has the signatures of his holy and vigorous mind. To allure our desires, he unveils the sanctuary above and discovers the glories and joys of the blessed in the divine presence. By a light so strong and lively that all the glittering vanities of this world vanishes in the comparison, and a sincere believer will despise him as one of mature age does the toys and baubles of children. To excite our fear, he removes the screen and makes the everlasting fire of hell so visible, and represents the tormenting passions of the damned in such dreadful colors, as if duly considered would check and control the unbridled licentious appetites of the most sensual wretches," end quote. Heavenly rest is a subject in its own nature so universally important and interesting, and at the same time so truly engaging and delightful, it sufficiently accounts for the great acceptance which this book is met with, and partly also for the uncommon blessing which has attended Baxter's manner of treating the subject, both from the pulpit and the press. For where are the operations of divine grace more reasonably to be expected, or where have they in fact been more frequently discerned than in concurrence with the best adapted means? And should it appear that persons of distinguished judgment and piety have expressly ascribed their first religious impressions to the hearing or reading the important sentiments contained in this book, or after a long series of years have found it both a counterpart and the improvement of their own divine life, will not this be thought a considerable recommendation of the book itself? Among the instances of persons that dated their true conversion from hearing the sermons on the Saints' Rest, when Mr. Baxter first preached them, was the Reverend Thomas Doolittle, who was a native of Kidderminster, and at that time a scholar about 17 years old, whom Mr. Baxter himself afterwards sent to Pembroke Hall in Cambridge, where he took his degree. Before his going to the university, he was upon the trial as an attorney's clerk, and under that character, being ordered by his master to write something on a Lord's Day, he obeyed with great reluctance, and the next day returned home with an earnest desire that he might not apply himself to anything as the employment of life, but serving Christ in the ministry of the gospel. His praise is yet in the churches for his pious and useful labors as a minister, a tutor, and a writer. In the life of the Reverend John Janeway, fellow of King's College, Cambridge, who died in 1657, we are told that his conversion was in a great measure occasioned by his reading the Saints' Rest. And in a letter which he afterward wrote to a near relative, speaking with a more immediate reference to that part of the book which treats of heavenly contemplation, he says, "There is a duty which, if it were exercised, would dispel all cause of melancholy. I mean heavenly meditation and contemplation of the things to which the true Christian religion tends. If we did but walk closely with God 1 hour in a day in this duty, oh, what influence would it have upon the whole day besides and the duly performed upon the whole life? This duty with its usefulness, manner, and directions, I knew in some measure before, but had it more pressed upon me by Baxter's Saints' Everlasting Rest, a book that can scarce be overvalued and for which I have cause forever to bless God. This excellent young minister's life is worth reading were it only to see how, delightfully, he was engaged in heavenly contemplation according to the directions in the Saints' Rest." It was the example of a heavenly contemplation at the close of this book, which Joseph Alain so frequently quoted in conversation with his solemn introduction, "Most divinely," says that man of God, holy Mr. Baxter. Dr. Bates, in his funeral sermon dedicated to Sir Henry Ashurst, says to that religious gentleman and most distinguished friend and executor of Mr. Baxter, quote, "He was most worthy of your highest esteem and love, for the first impressions of heaven upon your soul were in reading his invaluable book of the Saints' Everlasting Rest," end quote. In the life of the Reverend Matthew Henry, we have the following character given us by Robert Warburton of Grange, the son of the eminently religious Judge Warburton and the father of Mr. Matthew Henry's second wife. He was a gentleman that greatly affected retirement and privacy, especially in the latter part of his life. The Bible and Baxter's Saints Rest used to lie daily before him on the table in his parlor. He spent the greatest part of his time in reading and prayer, end quote. In the life of that honorable and most religious knight, Sir Nathaniel Barnard Diston, we are told that he was constant in secret prayer and reading the scriptures. Afterwards, he read other choice authors, but not long before his death, he took a singular delight in reading Baxter's Saints Rest and preparations thereunto, which was esteemed a gracious event of divine providence, sending it as a guide to bring him more speedily and directly to that rest. Besides persons of eminence, to whom this book has been precious and profitable, we have an instance in the Reverend James Janeway's Token for Children of a little boy, whose piety was so discovered and promoted by reading it, as a most delightful book to him next to the Bible, that the thoughts of everlasting rest seemed, even while he continued in health, to swallow up all other thoughts. And he lived in a constant preparation for it, and appeared more like one that was ripe for glory than an inhabitant of this lower world. And when he was in the sickness of which he died before he was 12 years old, he said, "I pray let me have Mr. Baxter's book, that I may read a little more of eternity before I go into it." Nor is it less observable that Mr. Baxter himself, taking notice in a paper found in a study after his death, what a number of persons were converted by reading his call to the unconverted, accounts of which he had received by letter every week, expressly adds, quote, "This little book, The Call to the Unconverted, God has blessed with unexpected success beyond all that I have written except the Saints' Rest." With an evident reference to this book, and even during the life of the author, the pious John Flavel affectionately says, "Baxter is almost in heaven, living in the daily views and cheerful expectation of the saints' everlasting rest with God, and is left for a little while among us as a great example of the life of faith." And Mr. Baxter himself says in his preface to his treatise of self-denial, "I must say that of all the books which I have written, I peruse none so often for the use of my own soul in its daily work as my life of faith. This is self-denial, and the last part of the saints' rest," end quote. On the whole, it is not without good reason that Dr. Calamy remarks concerning it, "This is a book for which multitudes will have cause to bless God forever."
Stillwater's Revival Books is now located at PuritanDownloads.com. It's your worldwide online Reformation home for the very best in free and discounted classic and contemporary Puritan and Reformed books, MP3s, and videos. For much more information on the Puritans and Reformers, including the best free and discounted classic and contemporary books, MP3s, digital downloads, and videos, please visit Stillwater's Revival Books at PuritanDownloads.com. Stillwater's Revival Books also publishes the Puritan Hard Drive, the most powerful and practical Christian study tool ever produced. All thanks and glory be to the mercy, grace, and love of the Lord Jesus Christ for this remarkable and wonderful new Christian study tool. The Puritan Hard Drive contains over 12,500 of the best Reformation books, MP3s, and videos ever gathered onto one portable Christian study tool. An extraordinary collection of Puritan, Protestant, Calvinistic, Presbyterian, Covenanter, and Reformed Baptist resources. It's fully upgradable and it's small enough to fit in your pocket. The Puritan Hard Drive combines an embedded database containing many millions of records with the most amazing and extraordinary custom Christian search and research software ever created. The Puritan Hard Drive has been produced to assist you in the fascinating and exhilarating spiritual, intellectual, familial, ecclesiastical, and societal adventure that is living the Christian life. It has been specifically designed so that you might more faithfully know, serve, and love the Lord Jesus Christ, as well as to help you to do all you can to bring glory to His great name. If you want to love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, then the Puritan Hard Drive is for you. Visit PuritanDownloads.com today for much more information on the Puritan Hard Drive, And to take advantage of all the free and discounted Reformation and Puritan books, MP3s and videos that we offer at Stillwaters Revival Books.